Chapter 2. Sleep, Doctor. Sing, dance, sting, and lance as you hail expanse and exhale chance. Breathe in the collective to change your perspective, but just the incentive to chase the introspective. The nighttime rounds. The nightmare sounds. The angel that comforts the boy as he drowns. So, send in the clowns. Send in the clowns. We are Arkham. Bound and demon found. Can you smell that burning sound? Burning sound. I do believe that we're going down, all the way down. If there's one thing I've learned over the centuries, it's that bad news and bad things invariably occur and manifest in the middle of the night. Things that, of course, would fill your dreams to the brim with fright. How indeed can you know what's wrong or right when it's vengeance that bathes in the never light? In this case, the exact year is not particularly important, listeners. All you need to know is it was at some point in the late 20th century, somewhere in your northern hemisphere, that a woman, a tall spindly brunette in her mid-30s, unsteady on her feet, began making her 17th cup of tea of the evening, armed, of course, with her beloved kitchen knife, her eyes like a thousand bags of sand. The crusty dust around the edges now almost audible as her unsteady blinks continued. How long had she been awake now? Too long.
Awake too long.
Do-da. Do-da. Wendy shook her head. She was doing it again. That song. A terrible song that had been crawling through her head and veins for months now, or years, driving her insane. It was because of him. It was always because of him. That stupid, bank account denting, good for nothing son of hers. Always hearing things, seeing things. And his father's encouragement didn't help. Her son's, let's call them premonitions, ranging from knowing there was someone at the door before the bell rings, to being able to predict future bodily harm right down to the body part and the object or structure Wendy would inevitably trip over. Not to mention the accurate recovery time for most of her various injuries. The first sentence he had ever uttered,
"Mind your head, Mama."
Wendy remembered when those words caused her eyes to well up with tears of pride, joy, love, and the conscious effort to pause before entering any room with a low-hanging doorway, which, thanks to Wendy's height and, let's be honest, income, that applied to every room in the tiny basement apartment Wendy shared with her husband and son. That husband. He wasn't exactly much better with his nonsensical stories of, what was it? Dimensional retro something. Wendy shook her head again. It wasn't fair. Why couldn't she just have a nice, normal family? With her husband's joint degree of philosophy and astrophysics that he still insisted on milking for all it was worth on one side, and her psychic, she had to get used to using that word, son on the other, and nearly 9 years into motherhood with no steady employment on either side of the marriage, sitting in this not even that glorified basement, hearing nothing but her husband's bullshit theories about the universe and her son's apparently accurate, mirror-based messages from a world beyond this one, according to various expensive mediums his father had insisted upon a couple of years back. Wendy's grip and perspective on reality had grown from, let's say, average to unique. Yes, she was happy with that scale, she thought as she stared hard at the steaming cup in front of her on the worktop. Average to unique. Her eyes caught the faded words on the side. World's greatest mama, it read. Wendy smiled, but with a pseudo-bulbar effect, a neurological condition that causes the sufferer to display one emotion while unknowingly or knowingly, depending on the person, expressing either another or the polar opposite emotion. In short, you smile through the pain and cry through the joy. And Wendy Wolf was smiling wide, baring those giant teeth she had always hated, feeling the irony of the faded words on the cup wash through her body as she drank deeply.
World's greatest mother,
she said, and began to laugh, not sure whether it was the PBA or just the general irony of her current situation. Sleep. She just needed to sleep and then the pain would stop. Jealousy welled up inside her. It's not fair, she thought, aloud this time. And it wasn't. The boys had been lucky. They had received their prescriptions. They got fast-tracked. Lucky bastards. The sleep doctor had taken care of them. Yes, sir, she had. Wendy's son had been asleep for a few weeks now. All it had taken was a simple push down the concrete steps.
Some madness is exactly like gravity.
The other doctors weren't exactly hopeful due to the severity of his head injury, along with the broken bones. But at least the healthcare was free. Sometimes low quality and slow, yes, but free.
Didn't see that coming, did you?
Wendy said, draining the cup.
No more visions. No more ghosts. No more predictions. No more people in the mirror. No more forewarned and yet equally life-changing head injuries.
Wendy paused, tracing the outline of the scar on her forehead, and of course, dreading the following automatic use of her peripheral vision. She could see the figure, a dark shadow in the shape of a man. Yet when she looked at the mirror, with her full vision, which she always did whenever he decided to camp out in the corner of her eye, almost always if you're interested, he was never there, yet always there. Never not there, watching her. Hopefully he would leave soon. Hopefully.
Awake too long. Do-da. Do-da,
the figure called. He left messages in breath sometimes. Drawings, glyphs, her husband had called them. Symbols, perhaps directions to places untold, or instructions to rituals forbade since the old ones first rose to earth. Turning away from the mirror, tears falling from her bloodshot eyes, Wendy responded, Do-da. Do-da. She looked down at her trusty kitchen knife, almost paying no mind to the matter still running from the blade's tip down to the bottom of the black plastic handle and onto the fake and badly varnished wood. I need to get some more Mr. Sheen, she said to herself. She ran a finger across the underside of the worktop, the knife's matter following the cut of the wood and beginning to drip to the linoleum floor. This place is a mess. She sighed, pulling out a pack of cigarettes from the pocket of her dressing gown, one that she practically lived in. It was cream when she bought it, but thanks to a recent accident, however, it was more of a blend at present. Kind of a reverse Cruella de Vil coat. That was my observation anyway. It's your fault, you know, Wendy said as she lit up, turning around to view her latest work.
All your fault.
And yours, she added, pointing to a severed arm. And yours, she said again, pointing to a recently pulverized eyeball. Wendy repeated this process until she had covered all the various body parts strewn across the areas of the linoleum floor and dining room table that sat across there. Well now, her, she supposed. Poor excuse for a conservatory. Should have got that ensuite like I suggested. So I'd at least now finally have a use for a bidet. She looked down again at her loving husband's left eye, then glanced at the state of the soles of her feet. Covered in blood, of course, and other liquids of varying densities, along with sweat, tears, mucus, and of course, the odd splash of plasma. Wendy had been at this for days now. She had spent most of the time frantically searching for the key to the garden shed while Yorick, most just called him Rick, when he was alive, struggled for his life. Rather ironically, the shed of course housed all the tools she would ever need. Tools that were now accompanying Rick's various entrails all over her crappy kitchen. And Wendy knew that, thanks to her son's little accident, she would have all the time she would need to cover her tracks. Or so she thought. There was something tickling the back of her brain. If Wendy was honest with herself, there was a lot of things rattling around back there. A lot of noise. But there was something else there now. Something new that she had been subconsciously ignoring ever since she began to make her 16th cup of tea. Or was it her 17th? A voice. A voice she could hear with her mind and not her ears. None other than my voice. A message on a loop. A kind of unfriendly warning. Not a threat. Just the kind of heads up that doesn't give you any prep time. One that wouldn't actually change the outcome that I knew was inevitable. Although Wendy did not. All she could hear was my voice. My voice. He will knock 4 times, I said, fiddling with the, let's call it a telepathic volume knob, to test her reactions. I needed to work out which of the thoughts in her head were overriding the others. I needed to find the pressure point. And of course, there was one. Her son. Despite all the terrible visions that had been subconsciously and somewhat indirectly beamed into her head by powers unknown to Wendy over the years, using her son as some kind of conduit and possibly using her dearly departed husband as some kind of storytelling beacon to entice and encourage the conduit on a desired journey. Despite all that, and all that might be bullshit, she still loved her son. It had been the visions, the seemingly endless sleepless nights that had made her do it. Was it that? She would like to believe it was. Or was this just what it was like, being a parent? She discarded that thought. Being a parent was not like this.
Especially since you chucked your baby boy down the stairs. You donut.
I heard her conscience say, in a raspy, malnourished voice. No doubt from lack of use.
You're such a donut. Always have been. He will knock 4 times.
She was thinking those words now. Or did she even say it aloud? She wasn't sure. Something was wrong. Something definitely felt wrong.
There's a lot wrong with this picture.
I threw in, as a one-off. The occasional change-up is often necessary, otherwise the unfriendly warning just joins the dark pale noise that is subconscious thought. Plus, I get bored very quickly. Wendy agreed with me. I could tell, partially because I could feel her panic rise, the sweat on her clammy, blood-soaked palms, and the uncontrollable shakes, but it was mostly because she was nodding vigorously. It wasn't that something was wrong. No, listeners, Wendy understood that now. It was because nothing was right.
Who's that at the door?
I said, and so did Wendy. It was a long walk to the front door, the longest of her life. The speed she was going at, any possible passing visitor or delivery person would have either given up or tried knocking again. This caller did neither, and Wendy knew exactly why. She knew that the caller could tell exactly how far away from the door she was, what she had done in the kitchen dining room behind her, and probably how long she'd been at it, what state of mind she was in, whether or not Wendy was armed, spoilers, she wasn't, and, most importantly, whether or not she was actually going to open the door. As she passed the living room and bedrooms on her left, Wendy was telling herself that she didn't have to open it, that she could escape, that all this would be over, and before long, finally, she herself could somehow sleep. She stood behind the locked door, her head against the stained glass, thinking, waiting. As she unlocked, she told herself not to be afraid, that there was no point in being afraid, that this was what she wanted, what she deserved, to be the victim of eternal sleep. She had been the victim in life, apart from when she was the murderer, and now she would be the victim in death, because she was going to die, probably just as, if not more brutally, than her husband had at her hand. And why? Well, because she was going to open the door. I mean, what kind of mother wouldn't open the door for her son? This was his home, after all. Still clad in a hospital gown, dark pale-skinned, silver-eyed, there was more than a hint of red that shouldn't have been present in those eyes, but I don't think Wendy noticed. There was a mixture of adoration and, of course, utter contempt in them too. Contempt and rage for his mother's despicable acts of violence. The scar on his head pulsating, his toothy grin wide. That knowing grin only became more and more terrifying as he got older. Wendy was thinking that. But on this occasion, I knew better.
Hello, Grayson,
Wendy stammered, craning her gangly body so her head was sticking out over the threshold, facing her son down in the only way she could. The obvious questions like, how the hell did you wake up from a coma, get out of a hospital unnoticed, and all the way back here, and not rip out your stitches in the process? Irrelevant. He was her son. In truth, she really shouldn't have been that surprised. No. Not after 9 years. Coma or no coma. She smiled. Or rather, in Wendy's case, her condition did the smiling for her. Inside, she was already dead.
Hello,
he said, craning his neck the opposite way. Wendy instinctively stepped back as little Gray stepped over the threshold, one small step closer to her demise.
Mind your head,
Mama.
Awake too long.
Do-da. Do-da. If you're a podcast clown like I am, you must have dreamed about starting your own. Let me tell you, my dreadful darlings, it's never easy, but it's one of the best decisions I ever made. It was either that or waste away in my own subjective ascendance. Of course, it can be more than just a little overwhelming to know how to get started. Buzzsprout can help you launch your podcast professionally and in style, linking you with all of the major podcasting platforms such as Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and much, much more. Join us up in the buzzing, sprouting podcast cloud to breathe in the renowned analytical sound of the accurate analysis and promotion tools provided. Follow the link in the show notes below to start your journey and receive a $20 Amazon gift card. We're waiting for you. Buzzsprout, the best and excitingly prettiest way to start a podcast.
What the hell are you doing? Redgrin? Redgrin!
What does it look like I'm doing? I asked. I was still floating, comfortably in the center of one of my meditation chambers, cross-legged, barefoot, toes wiggling with a sense of purpose. I was still slightly drowsy from the long-distance link-up, Your version of Earth is very far away from here, listeners, but lucky for me, it wasn't too far back from your present day. I wasn't exactly sure how long Jamie had been standing there, or to be honest, living here, in my house, relative to her home dimension. Had it been days? Weeks? I couldn't imagine it mattered to Jamie, given her brief stint in eternal, self-created purgatory. Since when did it snow in Summerland? Very funny, I said, without moving my lips. You've been eavesdropping, I added. My eyes were still closed, my head bowed in waning concentration. Long, bony fingers pressed against my pulsating temples, both quivering from long-term pressure. Nightmare meditation only seemed to be comfortable from the waist down, as was evident from my supremely yet temporarily rigid torso as contrast to my limp, weightless legs. I wasn't listening, I just heard. Some of it, anyway. Your psychic shouts are, disturbingly loud. I know, you can capitalize disturbingly. Do you have to levitate while meditating? Well, do you have to litigate while reanimating? I said, out loud this time. Jamie didn't seem to appreciate the resurrection joke, and so I unfolded my legs and returned to terra firma. Whenever you float, jealous, shut up. Whenever you do that, my bedroom flips upside down. I told you to activate the anti-grav panels on the underside of your bed. No, you didn't. Oh, maybe that was someone else. What even is this place? Some sort of hotel? Of a kind. What kind? The kind that have automated room service, matter application technology, and devices that compensate for metaphysical shifts in the dimensional atmosphere. Shifts that can cause certain rooms, ones like yours, to become vertical. My apologies. No problem. Anti-grav panels. I'll remember. Just give me a heads up next time. And not the kind you gave her. She looked at me, half smiling. Who, Wendy? Oh, don't worry about her. She dug her own grave a long, long time ago. Literally, in fact. And if I remember, she was without a head. Sounds nasty. Oh, she was. But she created something beautiful. And you know a hell of a lot about both, don't you? Come, sit. Fly with me. I gestured to the center of the glowing Rosetta Stone circle, stretching and widening the circumference to accommodate two as opposed to one. At the center of the crystal-encrusted circle was what I call a beholder, a crystal sphere bioorganically wired into House's growth heading pattern, through which could be seen where we are, where we have been, and most importantly, where we needed to go. Most of this was irrelevant to Jamie. She had basically just arrived. My choices to go certain places in my own past were irrelevant to her. I just needed to get her to focus. I can't, she said, suddenly looking disheartened. Don't give me that. I saw you on that church roof that night. And afterwards. I had bat wings. That transformation would have only been possible if your natural abilities aligned with that of the Seraph. If those bastards chose the form of a Seraph demon specifically for you, they must have already known you possessed the ability to at least temporarily defy gravity. Wings could be a representation of a perhaps temporary state of flight, suggesting that it takes a lot of effort or doesn't come with an ultimate sense of permanency. Do you always have to talk like this? She asked, now looking blank-faced. Yes. Now sit. Slowly, Jamie began to lower herself to the stone circle floor. I could see her double-take as she felt no pain in her lower body from the hot, jagged crystal. Then she spotted the transparent glass that covered pretty much every inch of the meditation chamber where the hot, crystalline structure was exposed to view. It's warm. It's hot. Well, I'm sure House does her best.
Your house is a girl?
Got a problem with that?
No, but where's all the heat coming from?
The source. What source? The power source, well, one of them. Something has to maintain stability. A source capable of suspending us in orbit underneath a collapsing star. That was your solution for time travel? Camp out under a black hole and grow away from it? Neat, don't you think? Can I see? When you're ready. Now, shall we? I sat opposite her. As this was a friendly jaunt through the field of reeds, rather than a view to burning it down like earlier, the glowing undercrystal's color morphed slowly from a bright, angry red to a calm, easing blue. So, I began, my hands spread out on my lap. I sit or float here, on occasion, in one of the many hidden eyes of the storm. I watch, I listen, I grow, and as I grow, house grows. The stronger my connection, the higher the chance of a threshold manifestation. Am I meant to understand any of that? You will, my dear. In time. But answer me this. How do you feel? Guilty. Other than guilty. Everyone feels guilty for something. I feel guilty when an innocent civilian trips over my slippery slices of cyanide toast. Especially if there's another one a few feet away, and they hit it full in the face. Instant death. I shivered. Yeah? Well, I feel guilty because I used and betrayed my friend in the worst possible way. You literally traded her soul for mine. I was merely Shire's guide through the Never Not There. You were the beacon she was trying to reach. And that takes a lot of magical skill. If you can do that, and live with it, flying shouldn't be a problem. Really? Well, who was it that said, leave it to dying to give you a whole new perspective on life? I paused, glancing at Jamie. Where before her body language had conveyed a more closed, aimless soul wandering the Duat, it was as if she could see a light in an unexpected direction and was making her way towards it, becoming less and less tentative with every step as the light grew brighter. And it did. The surrounding azure glow began to intensify, as if whatever Jamie thought was beyond the beholder, and the undercrystal, she still wasn't sure, was primed to erupt. Breathe, I said, soothingly. Jamie's eyes were closed now. Well, two of them were. Through my vision, and under House's starlight, Jamie's third eye was highly visible. Wild, wide, and purple. Pulsating. Pulsating with new breaths of life, taking in the sight of the crystalline structure and tearing up. To a non-magic user, it would have looked like Jamie was merely sweating from the vast heat. But I knew better. She was crying. Now, I said, look down. And she did. She regarded the 10-foot drop beneath both of us, the beholder now definitely smaller in size. Jamie stared open-mouthed, then back at me, then back at the drop, then at the fact that the shock of her sudden levitation revelation hadn't been enough to make her lose concentration. She maintained her altitude. She had come back different. Was that the word she wanted to use? More powerful? Or just more her? Go with the latter, I said silently. At one with her thoughts, and she with mine. The ones on display, anyway. If Jamie knew the true horrors that lay ahead, I think it highly likely that she would have appeared a lot less zen.